Accession number 28417, Reel 2.
Sir John, you noticed your working party was diminishing down to two men and your good self, and...
We all three nipped up to see what was happening, and our sister ship, another Q-class destroyer, was alongside the bow, and the remnants of our crew were leaping on board to be saved with speed and enthusiasm. So we abandoned our shoring up, sprinted up to the forecastle, and just made it as the last three to jump an increasing gap between the two destroyers. The other ship, took off at great speed after the cruisers, because we were still being bombed by aircraft. We headed back to Algiers. When we arrived at Algiers, my worldly possessions were down to my cap and my underpants and a watch, which was an instant during the whole of that. My worldly possessions at home had also gone, because my mother's possessions, which were in storage, had been burnt and blown up, and my mother had also been bombed out of her flat in London. So I was in the character-forming stage of having nothing in the world except myself. And it was a great, great lesson to me, and I must say I have been more or less non-materialistic ever since. It showed how very unimportant possessions were. But of course there was a problem of being identified in a pair of rather soiled underpants by then, and a rather badly burned cap, because of course had numbers of burning things falling on the cap. But anyway, I found that I had joined the Quentin anyway, although my paperwork never caught up with me. And we were eventually shipped home to England, where I was then sent on survivor's leave, which was a fortnight. It was a bit unfair, really, because I'd been sunk twice. I figured I ought to have had a month, but still. I was then, to my horror, appointed as a midshipman to the King George V of Scarpa Flow. And I had 3 months serving aboard her. And again, that finally convinced me there was no conceivable way I was going to join a big ship navy.
Why is that? Why was that?
Well, nobody knew anybody. You didn't know any sailors. Not that this was a primary aim, but you weren't really a person. You were just a number, and you were pushed around. And I ran a boat, which was a little bit of personal responsibility, but you had no real personal responsibility at all. You were just a cog in the thing. And if you were in action, apart from being shot at, there wasn't really any. And I'd had a bit of being shot at and wasn't yearning for more of it. I also, having been blown up twice, found I was very gun-shy. I hated loud bangs, and flinched and so looked wet. And generally speaking, didn't find my naval career in big ships to my liking at all. Anyway, after 3 months I was appointed, my tank had become promoted to subaltern, and I was again slightly ahead of the rest because of my good passing out results at Dartmouth, and we were as a term, reunited to our summer lieutenant's courses, which were specialist courses in gunnery, torpedoes, signals, what else? I think there is navigation, the four main ones anyway. And you did a 6 week or 3 month specialist course to teach you these particular skills, and you always had a passing out exam, and I by and large did pretty well in those and gained more seniority. At the end of our submarine courses, our courses, we were allowed to decide what we wanted to do as a specialist. And I really did want to do something a bit more active. And I felt, and one did in those days, I had a rather poor war. And a lot of my term had been in tales of derring do and all the rest of it. And I didn't really think, apart from 24 hours, I had a great deal to talk about or a great deal of experience. So I said I would like to join submarines. And that time they were mad short of volunteers. We long since ceased to have volunteer crews, but we were running out of volunteer officers as well for the submarine service. And I then went on submarine training at Blyth in Northumberland, and thoroughly enjoyed that, enjoyed submarines, met my wife in Newcastle. In fact, it seemed to me, and of course submarines had a great virtue, they were quiet. I mean, when you were being depth charged, they were relatively quiet. Although being depth charged is a bit like having your head inside a dustpan and suddenly banging it with a baseball bat. But it was a different sort of noise.
Is this a serious point, Sir John, that you... One of the things that attracted you to submarines was because it was quiet, because of your growing aversion to loud bangs.
Yes, and that was one of the things that attracted me. The primary thing, I was a bit more noble than that, and as much as mostly in submarines you were in action and things were happening, and you didn't have sort of months and months and months chasing a bloody raider in the hull of the South Atlantic. I mean, and also in those days the submarines were all pretty small. In fact, they were all small the whole of the war. But we only had limited patrols, 2 weeks or something like that.
And small in crew, so the crew would be...
40 to 50. And you knew everybody. And the ethos of the submarine was that everybody had to be able to do everything. And that by and large, everybody did do everything. So if, for example, you were in charge of torpedoes, you didn't just sit in a lordly manner, but you lent a hand on the blocks and tackles and did a job on the torpedo the same as the torpedo man and so on. So very much a hands-on, collaborative thing. And quite honestly, submarines during the war were, for me, the great formative experience. Because what submarines taught me, first of all, I knew my sailors much better than I had any of the others.
Well, you lived cheek by jowl, didn't you?
Absolutely. And, a lot of the time you were with two or three of them doing something, and you'd talk with each other. And I, for the first time, I don't say this with pride, but for the first time I realized how wretched the upbringing of most of my people had been before the war. The Navy didn't recruit before the war. from the cream of society. The bulk of our sailors were Bernardo's boys, broken homes, appalling East End or not honest fishermen sort of thing.
Unemployment in the 30s was the great driver enlistment, I'm told.
Well, it was. And, I mean, the lies that when one talked with these people, I mean, it really was a desperate life they come from. And some reasons were, I mean, I adored them, but they were not comfortable. They were very uncomfortable and very limited in space, and you had really a continual picnic, you know, great big thick sandwiches or bully beef or whatever. But I thought it was absolutely gorgeous, and because you were so much a member of a team. But going back to the lessons, I learned to this day what people are capable of so much more than they believe they are if they're asked and given the leadership and given the training and the preparation. And I really do believe, Summaries taught me above everything, the differences between officers and the men are bugger all. It's purely a matter of luck, and luck and training and upbringing. And, you know, you will never go wrong by asking more of your people than you think and they think they can give. And this is something which has been absolutely fundamental to me. And I still cannot for the life of me to tell you, you know, one of the great problems with being British is when you're brought up, you believe that there's somewhere a bunch of supermen who run the country. The rest of you bums, you know, just go on and do the ordinary jobs. But the big decisions are taken by quite different people of quite a different order. And Summaries were the first of my eye-openers, and the second of my eye-openers was when I was appointed to the cabinet offices after the war and saw my great heroes close to, and realized they were just the same mixed-up bums that all the rest of us are, but they had bigger jobs. And that is still a fundamental belief, and one which I just wish we'd teach properly in schools.
But it is the case that, broadly speaking, the people that do the bigger jobs have the more powerful intellects and the more driving ambition, or is that not the case?
I don't believe so.
You don't?
In any case, I don't think... they may have the more driving ambition. I don't think they've necessarily got the greater intellect. In many cases, I think they're even dumber than the rest of us. No, I really don't think it works that way. And after all, what matters in life are qualities of character, stickability, humility, the ability to listen, the ability to encourage and lead, empathy, concern. These are the qualities that actually should bring you to the top, but they're not. The ones who get to the top are the highly ambitious schemers and all the rest of it. Not always. The Navy was pretty good in this respect. By and large, far more people in the Navy failed to get as far as they could. And by and large, if you've got it in you, you've got a long way. ITI was unique in this. I never ever met a man in ICA who had failed to get as far as his natural abilities would get him. That is really one of the key things in running big outfits. Anyway, now where was I? I joined submarines.
Can I first of all thank you very much for that digression. But secondly, an extremely mundane question. You went on 2-week cruises, but what were the conditions like? How did you... You washed in seawater, or...?
Didn't wash.
I mean, we were very short of everything. Very short of water. I mean, I...
Short of fresh water?
Oh, yes. Unbelievably so.
Even for drinking?
We had about a gallon a day for everything. Cooking, drinking, washing, a lot.
Per man?
Yeah. And, I mean... difficult to give a picture of the space, but I mean, the only combined wash and loo was smaller than a telephone box, and you could, there were no bathing facilities or shower or anything like that. You could a little stainless steel hand basin. I mean, it really was, for a boy, an absolute heavenly muck.
and no one shaved then? I mean, no. Normal, if you like, normal naval regulations in some areas?
Oh, the submarines had no relationship to... I mean, we didn't even have a proper uniform. We used to go to sea in a submarine sweater and... very often a pair of grey flannels or something like that. And again, depending on where you were, because I submarine all over the world, but in the Far East, you either wouldn't wear anything or you wear a hand towel on your waist. And you've slept. We were lucky, we shared bunks. I mean, a hot bunking system, so you always got into somebody else's bunk. Or I started sleeping on the wardroom table, had to be got up for meals and so on. Or even worse, had to be got up if we had a cipher to be ciphered. I mean, it was a very, very simple life. And everybody ate the same. Everybody... in those days, of course, there were large numbers of people who smoked. I had always smoked a pipe, but you couldn't smoke a pipe in a submarine, and I more or less gave up smoking during my submarine time.
And the presumably the duration of your cruises was determined by diesel and fresh water? Supplies
No, ideally by how long it took you to fire your torpedoes. I mean, if you could get rid of the lot, and ideally hit something, but there was a strong incentive. I mean, the only thing you virtually never, although I did on a couple of occasions run out of ammunition for the gun, but we always used to seeing things with the gun rather than the torpedo, because torpedo was bloody expensive. Well, we thought in those days they were £10,000.
So how many did you carry?
Six.
Just six?
Yeah. Well, sorry, we had... No, that was a wrong answer. We had six tubes with a torpedo in them, and then six reloads, which you carried, on which the sailors slept. But, of course... And you never fired a single torpedo. You always fired a minimum of three to get a spread, and up to six if it was really a worthwhile target.
And these torpedoes didn't have acoustic devices in
them? Oh, nothing, no. Had to hit.
So you had to...
You had to actually hit the ship.
It was quite an art then, or a science, I should say, to calculate the 101 different variable factors.
Well, which is why you had a fire number. And it was very crude. I mean, the captain would, who was the only guy who... I mean, the reason you had a captain, and indeed I had one captain in submarines, who believed the whole purpose of all the rest of us was just to carry him around and put him inside of a ship. And he wasn't a very good shot either. But, I mean, everything depended on his ability. And he would look through the periscope, give the angle, give his estimate of the direction the ship was coming in. You'd plot the range, and so you plot the course of the target. And the whole thing, you had a thing called a fruit machine, which was rather like a Wurlitzer, in which you entered these various things, and that would then tell you how much you had to aim off by. But of course, remember, when you fired a torpedo in those days, it wasn't like a gun or a shot. I mean, the bloody thing waggled all over the place and quite often didn't even go in the direction you fired it. I mean, there were ships that were sunk by their own torpedoes, which just turned around and came back and sank them. Very simple stuff.
No account taken of tides and currents, I suppose, or were you able to...
Well, generally speaking, you fired from so close.
How close is so close?
Well, I mean, ideally you'd fire from about 2,000 yards. You might go out to 4 to 5, but you see, anything above about 2,000, there's travelling time, because the torpedo only did about 50 knots. Yeah, there was so much elapsed time between firing the bloody thing and it going allegedly where it was meant to be going. Ideally, you choose to try and fire under about 1,000 yards.
That's very close.
Yeah. Well, the closer you got, the better.
Of course. Of course. So finding your target, was that a matter of chance? Because presumably these ships could go faster than you.
Always. And, I mean, once you were dived, I mean, the absolute maximum of speed you could do dived was about 10 knots. And you could only do that for an hour.
Because of the drain on the battery.
Yeah. So, I mean, in reality, you could manoeuvre, but only marginally. And since you had to aim, in those days, you couldn't angle the torpedo. You had to aim the whole submarine. So, again, a combination of the speed at which you could turn the submarine and everything else. It was an incredibly sort of hit-miss thing. Mm. It was only really by getting close that you really succeeded at all.
But you could only get close almost by luck, because...
No.
No?
No, well, you... Well, yes.
I mean, if you saw a ship 6 miles away that was equal to your speed, he would escape you, wouldn't he?
Well, if he knew you were there, but of course the thing is, you would... I mean, the whole of a submarine life was being able to see and doing so quicker and better than they did. And particularly when you're on the surface at night, submarines were very low in the water, very difficult for ordinary ships to see. You could get very close before they picked you up. But curiously, I mean, the other thing is you were figuring you didn't know where the hell you were. Because you could only fix yourself by the stars. And quite often, I mean, for example, I did something like 3 cruises off Norway to try and intercept the Tirpitz. And on each occasion, the weather was so appalling, you couldn't get a star fix at all. And because the weather was so appalling, when you were on the surface, you had to go on the surface to recharge the engine, the batteries, you could really only survive by steering into the waves. So you can imagine the plot of where you thought you were was all over the bloody place.
When you say survive only by steering into the waves, because the seas were too big for you otherwise.
Yeah. And again, I mean, off Norway, it's the worst weather I think I ever had. The submarine used to dive. We used to roll at 100 feet down.
Did you really?
I mean, normally, about 30 foot or 40 foot, and you were all right. But off there, I mean,
huge troughs and peaks.
Yeah.
Right.
You don't want to go through the whole of my submarine career, do you?
I'd like you to touch on the principal points, if you would.
Well,
do you want to have a
No, fine.
Fine. Okay.
I was then lucky because although I was appointed to one training submarine, but even that one was diverted to join the screen trying to catch the herpes. I, by and large, was in operational submarines from then until the end of the war. I started in the smallest type, which was a V-class submarine, which had a crew of about 32, including the officers, and we were operating from Malta, and we're operating in the Aegean, which was a fascinating place to operate at that time, because really, although the Germans had occupied some Italians still, had occupied the Aegean Islands, they were very thin on the ground. The excitement of operating there was the Germans had sown mines the whole way around the bottom of the Aegean. So you had to go through minefields to get in and out. And we had a rather hairy little thing called a short transmission unit, which would give you about 100 yards warning if there was a mine ahead of you. We used to have to go through the minefield dived, and you really could do very little to avoid when you knew there was a mine. I always felt we were better not to have known at all, but still, you used to try and zigzag through. And we had ridiculous charts which had the positions of the detected mines, but since again, you never knew where you were very accurately. An almost total waste of time. But still, once inside the Aegean, most of the targets were kikes, little fishing boat type things, and we used to
which were not crewed by locals. They would be crewed by Germans and Italians.
No, they varied. They were very off. Well, they were crewed by locals, or they were crewed by a special boat squadron, where they had ridiculous signs like. Two pieces of washing on the quarter, would indicate it was one of us. But then every bloody guy had pieces of washing. But you used to sometimes leap aboard a kite with a crew or eight scruffy-looking buggers. They all produced their pay books. But we were mostly trying to interrupt traffic between the islands. Occasionally we pick up or sink something with Germans or Italians. Occasionally we used to go into a harbour on one side of an island while the Germans were the other side. And occasionally when we were being attacked by aircraft, we get a message saying, don't worry about the aircraft circling above you, we took his bombs. It was a really boys and paper war. We sank quite a number of things, did a few operations, but again, it was good because you were in the operating area within sort of 3 or 4 days of leaving Malta. And when you got back, they more or less stopped bombing water. So you had a reasonably peaceful time there. Anyway, after I think...
We're looking at the end of 43 now, are we?
Yes. After I think about 4 operations in the Aegean, the war was coming to a close. And there, and there's not much happening in the Aegean itself. The Germans have been mostly wiped up. And so we were shipped from Malta and told to go on to the Far East. Well, we ended up in Colombo.
When you say shipped, you didn't take your submarine?
No, we drove the submarine.
You drove the submarine?
Yeah. When we got to Colombo, the Voracious was not the far enough range to operate off the Andaman Islands, which is where...
The V-class, the little V-class submarines.
Yeah. So we were then turned into a clockwork mouse to train destroyers and so on. And that was not what I wanted to be in submarines for. So I again volunteered and asked whether I could be appointed to a proper submarine and join the Sea Scout, which was the one size up with a crew of about 45. I joined the Sea Scout.